I'm Will Kennedy, and we wanted to talk today about church education, church schools, parish education, or if you'd like, theological education, a church day school, the church colleges. They all fit into a basic strategy picture, but we don't usually think of them as an integrated strategy of education by the churches. But the question that was posed that brought us together has to do mainly with parish education. So I think it'd be helpful if before I give a little bit of background, if we got some idea of what kinds of questions and concerns people bring. So how about us sharing that sort of thing, see what sort of agenda we might have.
I'm interested in a church school.
Meaning Sunday school? No,
like a kindergarten through six or something like that.
Uh-huh. And on Sunday?
Weekday and daycare too.
In a parish, but a day school. All right.
I'd be kind of interested in really defining the contrast between such a school and a public school.
What's distinctive about a church school,
right,
and so forth? Most of us need some help in self-starting.
Or they've already started this.
Well, I've been in both situations, so I'm just curious.
Well, let me give a little bit of background. How many of you were here yesterday? And the rest of you, the tape's available, I hope, and let me just sort of connect it up briefly, and then let's look at these detailed questions. I think the problem we face today in church education that calls for different types of strategies is that the inherited patterns aren't working so well. The patterns that developed largely in the 19th century in this country, partly as carryovers from the old sod, as the Irish say, from back home in Europe, when we brought over patterns of established churches. And so the adaptations to the American environment that took place in the 19th century are largely the patterns we have today. A parish that has a Sunday morning worship service, where is the central meeting place of the people of God in that particular church congregation that week. Connected with that from the early days, pioneer days of the Westward Movement, a Sunday school that took advantage of the people gathering to teach largely the children, although in many places a very full adult education program as well. That pattern tends to appear in the so-called Bible Belt areas of the South and the Upper Midwest, more so than in the Northeast and around the West Coast, perhaps. I'm not sure about how it is in your location. Often the Sunday school preceded the church in the Westward Movement, and often it preceded the public school. In other words, when a group of settlers would carve out a place in the woods and start farming, there was no preacher there. A wandering preacher might come by from the Methodist or something. They would raise up a Baptist preacher sometime and say he's our preacher and ordain him in some fashion and have a Baptist church. That's why the Baptists cleaned up. They didn't have to have seminary educated clergy the way the Lutheran and Presbyterians did. And so often what would happen every Sunday would be a Sunday school with lay people running it. and the visiting preacher or the Sunday school missionary worker, extension worker, would look for somebody in that community who'd been in a Sunday school back east before they came across the mountain. And if they found such a person, they'd say, you be the superintendent, and you be the teacher, and they'd give them little tracts and Bibles and pamphlets and New Testaments and stuff. And they'd get going on a Sunday school. Later, as the town developed, they'd try to get a teacher. And a teacher would come in and start a school, and then they'd try to get a resident preacher, or at least an itinerant preacher, who would come by with some regularity for the sacrament and for confirmation type stuff, although it was not a patterned confirmation exercise as many of the churches back in Europe had, and as the Lutheran Church has traditionally had. But those 19th century patterns depended on a kind of Christian ethos. The culture was Christian. There weren't many competitors for the time and energy on Sunday morning. And the reference system was Christian. Almost everybody knew the Ten Commandments. They didn't honor them always by obeying them, but they knew what to feel guilty about. And they knew it was related to God. And Jesus' talk was common. So that as we moved into the middle 20th century, and after the two wars and the dislocations and the rapid growth of population and the continuing mobility and urbanization, what we call, under the loose term, secularism hit more and more places, so that preachers now going out into a new congregation have a hard time preaching with biblical references, because often the people don't know the biblical references. They don't know Moses from Agamemnon. And so the preacher has a difficult kind of time. Now, that plus the pace of life has raised up all kinds of other competitors. The now books and TV and cinema and all kinds of competing entertainment and meaningful entertainment for people. So the church is in a new kind of competitive situation. Now, when you add all that up, and we could play with that analysis, the Sunday schools and the relatively casual kind of education they could do with amateur teaching, without any serious expectation of homework or disciplined study, with 1 hour a week, and that usually was drained down to less because of opening exercises or whatever. By the time you had the shift of the ground underneath that strategy that developed into that kind of parish-centered educational program, the expectation on the Sunday school and that parish education model, youth work at night and so forth, Bible school in the summer, whenever you could find spare time, you could set up an educational involvement type program. But as the ground shifted from underneath it in the culture, we expected it to do more and more. And my basic sense of the thing is that those questions then that now come to the church for education are much more difficult to answer, and that the inherited strategies just don't do it. The new demands on the church are forcing us to some new searches for new strategies in education. So that in many ways, I think in our generation, we've got the best materials we've ever had. The stuff that comes out of Queens Lane in Minneapolis is very well done stuff. The psychological development type stuff that Doris has that understands what really fits different age levels of young people and so forth, and how do you introduce them to Christian faith, how do you nurture them in Christian faith. We've got some of the best analysis of that, and some of the best materials, and some of the best leadership training opportunities we've ever had. And yet, it's doing less and less of a good job. Now, that's not because of lack of dedication, or lack of commitment, or lack of working within that framework of strategies. What's happening is that the ground shifted, and that particular set of strategies that ties it to school-type stuff in a parish is less effective than it was when there was a different ground. Now, the longer background on that, I think, gets into some of the questions we talked about yesterday. If you just reflect a little bit imaginatively on what print technology and the affluent period in which we've developed schools, the effect of that on Christian education, think of how text-oriented we are. Think of the effect on learning from the kind of Catholic model of parish life to the literacy-centered model we inherit in Lutheranism and Reformed tradition in the Protestant churches. When we tried to remove the priestly mediation 450, 500 years ago, when we said it's not right for priests with the power of the sacraments to stand between us and God, and every person ought to be able to stand directly related to God, we substituted the Bible as the means for that to happen. Now, the Bible before that, and to a large degree ever since, has been a mystery book for the professionals. And so we shifted the dependency from the sacramental mediation to the textual mediation of Scripture. And so inevitably the goal of education in the church for lay people with that kind of approach theologically was, in order for people to relate to God, they had to know the Scriptures. And know meant a lot of cognitive content. So we set our schools, and before the 16th century, there hadn't been many schools except for the priests, or the professional. Lawyers, doctors were beginning in the universities. But now every lay person was sort of expected to know the Bible the way a priest knew the Bible. And that loaded our educational understanding with a whole lot of classroom-type knowledge, information about Scripture. And we have grown up in that tradition. Unless you have a sweep of the history of Revelation in Scripture, from the Exodus to the exile to Jesus Christ in the early church, for instance, you don't really have enough grounding to get to God straight. Now, we don't usually put it that way, but that's why it is so easy to remain dependent on the biblical experts and on a school pattern that has concentrated on that kind of cognitive knowledge. Now, biblical literacy then has emphasized the question of leadership. What kind of teaching do we then need? Whereas before, in the kind of medieval parish, there would be some explanation of the stained glass windows that they were making and putting in the cathedral. There'd be mystery plays that would come by. The liturgy included the creed, which was sort of a summary of faith, biblical story. It would include some Ten Commandments, which were sort of a guide to ethics. The priests were hearing confessions, and they had manuals that would guide them in how to interpret the response to different types of sins as the styles of sinning change from century to century. So that there was a kind of ongoingness in the ordinary life, and meaning was brought into it or brought out of it as that sort of happened. Now, when you move to a school model from that model, you then bring life into the schoolroom and package it and apply meaning on the assumption that when you get out of the schoolroom, it will affect what happens. And all of us who've taught know that that's an assumption that you don't really want to test too far, because of the slippage that occurs in getting something in somebody's head and expecting it to affect where their feet go and what their arms do. So that in the process of that whole shift, we have boxed ourselves into a dependency on schools and a dependency on literate professional experts that, if to put it very crudely, I think in often may offer as much a blockage to our access to God as the medieval priest with the control of the sacraments did. Now, with that kind of background, emphasis on the cognitive, the relative lacking of motor learning and effective learning, except separated from education. That happens in some other exercise, worship or liturgy. And education is increasingly squeezed into the rational cognitive and identified with schooling. There's one other little trick on that that we need to be aware of, and that's the dependence on the income from sales of materials. I don't know how it is in the Lutheran churches, but in many churches, including Presbyterian ones I know in this country, the church has never budgeted seriously for education. It inherited from the old Sunday school a Sunday school offering, and in many churches it still has to pay for the materials for study. So that the materials for study are bought, published by church presses, but the church presses cannot call on the kind of massive profits that CBS has when it gets into the curriculum production business. So that the sales of materials have to pay for writers and editors and designers of all those materials. It does not come out of the church's giving like mission money. And it may not be quite that simple, but at any rate, by and large, the creative development of educational programming has had to find another track of funding in the church than some of the other exercises of the church. That has meant all kinds of subtle kinds of things on materials. For instance, in one of the major curriculum sets that's known now, the so-called Christian education shared approaches, they have four tracks. They have a track on knowing the word, and that's the old uniform lessons, updated. But it's for people who just want Bible content, and they don't want much else. Then they've got one called interpreting the word that gets into the more hermeneutical kinds of things that Paul Hansen's been dealing with. They try to help you understand that there's some serious lacks if all you do is just add up biblical knowledge and think that's going to solve modern Christian dilemmas. Interpreting the Word, but that's still a text-oriented curriculum. Then they've got one called Living the Word, which starts with experience, with problems of children and activities of children, and then tries to tie it in dialogically. Then they've got one called Doing the Word, which is more action-reflection, which tries to take questions like global justice or peace, nuclear disarmament, whatever, the major questions that emerge in history, and start there and say, what are Christians doing about it, and what can we learn from what they're doing about it, and how can we bring in the resources of the tradition that are needed in order to enrich it? Well, guess what sells? What sells is Bible knowledge. Incredible amounts of Christian investment in that one. Some significant sales in interpreting, some in this, because with children, children's teachers have found that approach much better in many ways than starting from the end of the Bible and then bringing the kids to that instead of the opposite dialogical beginning point. Both of them end up with the same sort of back and forthness. This one hardly sells at all, partly because that kind of learning is not as book-oriented, partly because it's always out of date. To publish a book, you got to stop time, and history doesn't work that way. So that by the time you get a piece out, even under the quickest, you're dealing with a year's lag or so. If you deal with current secular materials, then you've got to have a totally different framework for training teachers to know how to use stuff that doesn't already pre-digest part of the bridging for you. So that in the whole process, the dependency on sales of texts has been part of the strategy formation of Christian education, and that's another blockage to easy change. If it takes money, where are you going to get money? Are you going to take it away from preachers' pensions? Heavens no. Are you going to take it away from mission money? No, sir. Are you going to take it away from keeping the church warm or cool with a good organ? No. so that you've got some fundamental problems locked into the inherited strategies that make it hard to be very creative. Now, it's in that kind of context that I think we need to analyze the new context for it, hunt for the best clues, and try to develop them, and put some of our energy in experimentation. Because simply to try to improve within that old pattern, as I spent most of my ministerial life trying to do, doesn't answer the deeper problems that are caused by the deeper shifts. So it's in that context, I think, that we come not feeling guilty because our best efforts aren't doing as much, but trying to say our uneasiness at the lack of success ought to lead us to be experimenting and searching for some new models in what's obviously a time of transition, and we need to hunt for some new ways that we can put energy in to develop that may serve the church in the next century as well as the old methods have served it in the previous century. And some of those may need to be retooled and continue to be used, of course. That's assuming we have another century. Now, that's kind of the background, but come at me on some of that if you'd like, and then we'll turn to the particular question at church. Good, Bill?
How well can we do it before if we don't, haven't spent much time in number one or number two, or is it, you know what I'm saying? We need some, I don't know if you're saying we don't need a one or the Bible background, and you know what I mean? But how do you mix them all up and do them all? Are you advocating a four without the one, two, three?
No, you can't have that very long. That's why the division into those four is an attempt to package options so that you can meet groups of people in local churches where they are. Each of them tries to do the whole, of course. And I was caricaturing slightly by those are approaches. They are not total classified sections. And one of the things, one of the books, let me pass it around, this just published, it's by an old colleague of mine, Sarah Little, who's a top-notch Christian educator. It's a study of teaching and different models of teaching and the relation of teaching to belief. I just read this morning the last of her chapters on action-reflection model, which is that fourth kind of thing, and she's talking about how it runs out pretty quickly if you don't have some reference in Scripture and in understanding of the church's tradition. And often the activist groups feel that need. Some of them burn out because they don't deal with that need and the need for a worshiping community. Let me read you a quotation before I send it around. One of the things that has happened in the last few years very strongly is working on what we might call Christian socialization. That is, putting the teaching of content in the context of life in the Christian community and recognizing educationally how that happens. And this is a quotation from one of the books I use in my courses by Ellis Nelson, called Where Faith Begins, and he says, my thesis is that faith is communicated by a community of believers, and that the meaning of faith is developed by its members out of their history, by their interaction with each other, and in relationship to the events that take place in their lives. So that when I start my course with people on Christian education who come from a lot of different backgrounds, some of them not much church experience, one of the things I like to do is to chase them into a local parish and ask them to analyze through interviewing the preacher and a couple of lay people, who meets whom where for what purposes? And start your thinking about education from the interaction. What is the nerve system of that community that holds it together as a body? And that includes your worship, your fellowship activities, your pastoring activities, and your educational activities, and your money activities. Now, all of those are places where there is some kind of operational theology at work. It's not always recognized, not always admitted when it's recognized. It's not always related to the growth of the community's understanding of faith, which is the educational task. So once people do that, then I ask, what kind of learning is going on there? And then how can that whole thing be enriched by an educational look at it? And so then go back to the pastor or the Sunday school superintendent or the elders or whoever and say, when do people learn in that interaction? And what do they learn? And what could they learn? What kind of needs for learning do they have that aren't being met? And then you look at the strategy of education and you see the classroom Bible study as related to the activities that go on. Now the only problem with that is that that tends to deal with the churchy side of their lives rather than their life out in the world. And so there's a sort of tilt inward that always happens when you strategize about church education. So I didn't mean to imply that was separate, but what I'm suggesting is that our identification of knowledge in terms of information about the Bible and classroom cognitive-oriented identification of education has put some limitations on the wholeness of learning and the wholeness of the community learning experience. You want to go on with that, Bill?
No, I'm okay.
There are many successful elementary schools in churches. What has been their secret of their success?
You're talking about day schools.
I'm talking about day schools now.
Now, let's talk about day schools. Technically, what this has been called in American educational history is parochial schools.
Yes.
Mostly, they have been Catholic. The Protestant denomination that's had the most is the Christian Reform, but increasingly, they're Lutheran ones and Presbyterian ones and many others. And that's the two questions we had. What about church schools and the relationship to public schools? Some of you are involved in that. Let's have some other suggestions about it. What makes it work when it works? What clues could we get that makes that a viable part of a total strategy? Mm-hmm.
Perhaps make stressing the application of what they're learning and putting it into practice. At least in the Christian day school, which I've been experienced, you not only teach lifestyles and how to carry it, but if a child is caught, you can make an example, not by name, but say, we know what we are to do, but it doesn't do any good to know it if when you leave here you actually don't follow through. And I think application is a big, just the knowledge that you are to do it is one thing, but to actually do it is what makes it successful.
And what you're supposed to do comes from what? How do you determine what's right?
What you are supposed to do?
Yeah.
I always approach it from a Bible perspective. We have how we are to live, and this is actually living it. I mean, you have to have that Bible knowledge and then live it, or it doesn't do one any good.
So that in a Christian day school, you can very openly and explicitly teach religious material and try to make it applicable in the interrelationships of the
It's a whole
school.
Program, like on your playground, in your lunchroom, on your just greeting a child in the morning, this type of thing. And you don't have that so much in the public schools. Like you'd have an aid to the playground, I find, is a great learning experience. Really?
What don't you have in the public school?
You have aids on the playground. You're not allowed to reinforce your religious beliefs on the children. If you do, you're likely to get stepped on. You can say, well, be kind to this person, don't take this away, and that type of thing. But there's no carryover. There's nothing. There's no base to put it on for why you do this.
I suppose it depends on who your teachers are in public school.
Yeah.
Your Christian teachers are probably.
Well, it makes a difference somewhat in the area of the United States you're teaching in, too. I mean, there's vast differences, you know, whether you have community support or not.
Just because you have good teachers doesn't mean that you have good aides. I find this is a big complaint in our town, that I've heard parents say they send their children to our ALC church school because they eliminate the filthy language that is just common day, you know, expected. on the public school playground, and I go from school to school and talk about child abuse, and I go into the teacher's lounge and hear these aides talking, and I think, those people are watching our children? You know, that, they don't have to pass any kind of criteria in order to, or live up to any criteria in order to be a school aide or a playground supervisor.
Let's make sure, I may not be the only one here who doesn't know particularly what an aide is or does. Is that an employee of a Christian day school who works in a classroom?
Well, they have them in the Christian day school, but there they are, you know, they're...
Every public school, at least all the ones in our area, have aides now. And they're either in the classroom and they're always on the playground. The teachers are not on the playground and they're in the basically in the lunch situation. A lot of the, like you were talking about, the interactive type activities, the aides end up.
And they are not. They are not.
And they're me. They're just Harriet Housewife. That
are they volunteers?
Oftentimes.
Yeah, I have
my friends are aides.
So. I was an aide 2 years ago for junior high school, and a lot of my duties were just grading papers. I never went on the playground.
Yeah.
And grading papers, and also every so often they'd split the class up, so the teacher would take group B and I'd teach group A. You know, that type of thing.
Did you? Yeah.
Sometimes I had no contact with the class at all. I was just sitting back and grade papers. You know.
Did you get paid?
Yeah. You know, minimal salary.
Half what the teacher got?
Oh.
No. Less. I think our aides get 575.
Yes, 475.
Any credentials?
We have teacher certified.
Oh, yeah. I'm a certified teacher, but I was just trying to work.
But you could. I could go be an aide. And
with,
I'm a nurse.
With
yeah.
No certification.
Right.
No.
There
education
are a lot of aides who are not certified teachers.
And just that the principal likes them.
Well, in fact, you can't be an aide and be a certified teacher in one district. I know that. Mm-hmm.
So it's a hierarchical system, really,
yes.
Stemming from economics. Huh?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's just the way the aides talk with the children on the playground. I mean, they don't treat them like people.
I know that can be limited to just aids.
Of course, you can't make a blatant blanket statement about anything.
No,
but there is so much of that.
Aids maybe are more prone to it because they could be younger. You know, they don't need the certification. They might not have gone through college yet. But you know, there are teachers who are younger than I was who are just. As you know, the problem could
there be. Are poor teachers too, of course, but they don't usually get by with it.
I think my problem was as an aide, which is what you were talking about. I found in the public schools my problem was I would teach this content material, and I really had no basis for teaching it. I felt if the kids weren't interested, you know, in English or exploring things about the world, you know, I couldn't appeal to any basic belief within them that the world is good, God created it, because that isn't there, you know, and I couldn't really approach that in the public school setting either, because the public school is so hands off anything spiritual or religious. And I found the whole setting really empty and almost impossible to teach any content material without first addressing that the basic reason of I can teach how to survive, but why survive, you know? Mm-hmm. And I couldn't address that in the schools or the public schools, and that's why I've been interested in, you know, mm-hmm. thinking of parochial, simply because that would be a framework where I could maybe address that major issue.
I think you put your finger on the basic difference.
Thought about it a lot.
I wonder if there's not a problem developing, I don't know much about parochial schools, but developing in parochial schools as the reasons for sending children to parochial schools change. I sense that some years ago it may have been Bible education, it may then have been a kind of moral education that the public schools didn't offer, but now I wonder if parochial schools aren't in danger of simply pandering or attracting students and primarily parents, I think, who either want to escape from the secular influences they see in public schools, or even more, just want to flee from public schools as tax revolts all across the country knock public schools in the head. So that the reasons the private schools are filling up now has nothing to do with morality, really, or has nothing to do with the kind of specific things that might be learned there, but have a lot to do with simply getting out, bailing out.
Get the kids away from drugs, get the kids away from undisciplined situations.
Get a decent education. I know that there's one school in Milwaukee where I was living last year, that they said when children were transferred out of public schools into their school because the parents wanted this or that, you know, the kind of things you're mentioning, they found that these children had to be placed one, two, or even three grade levels behind where they were because the Christian school was giving them such solid and really, you know, good education, and these children that were coming out of the public school didn't know how to think. They knew how to be entertained by this or that, you know, project or thing, or watching a TV show or something in the public school, and that's as much a reason as anything is to give them a.
But even there, there's a split. There are some private or parochial schools which are established and have high standards and are better than public schools, and there are a lot of, I think, kind of fly-by-night tossed together, especially the fundamentalist or evangelical schools operating out of church basements without qualified teachers, because there aren't certification rules.
It's the old pendulum thing. We're always going to one extreme or the other.
But I do think that's a good point. And the school, my kids go to a Missouri Synod Lutheran operated school. We're ALC, that about a third of the kids there are Lutheran, a third are other denominations, and a third are no denomination whatsoever. And if you ask those people, why did you send your kids here? It's what you said. It's either escape from the drugs at the middle school, there's usually a large influx of kids in the sixth, seventh grades, or even if you're not a Christian, you may have moral standards above and beyond what's perpetuated in a lot of the junior highs and middle schools today, that type of thing. And we've lived in our town 13 years, and there were just the Catholic schools and the Lutheran schools, and now there's a Baptist school, and there's a SDA school, and there's a Riverview something or other, and there's a community school. It's just like
kind of mushroom.
At Liberty School, but you don't know what that one is. One started with 7 kids. I mean, you know, they're just, it's.
And I fear for that type of thing. I agree with you there.
Well, on the one hand, it might be a sign of life in the way that you were talking about yesterday. Maybe it's good that people are going to schools with 7 kids in them or something.
I know the ALC and the LCA have entirely different philosophies about Christian day schools. The LCA believes in supporting the public schools and doing everything they can to improve the public schools, while the ALC promotes parochial schools. There is a difference in general.
Well, let's pursue those on out into the larger structures. Private education, use another term for this, is expensive. Do the churches where you live offer enough scholarships so that you have the same socioeconomic spread in the private school that they have in the public school? Or does it inevitably tend toward those who can pay more, and therefore the upper middle class?
Ours, Missouri Synod Lutheran, and their church sends their kids. Anybody who wants to go can go, whether they pay the tuition or not. Everybody else has to pay the tuition to go, though.
There's a point.
They do help. If some family's gotten into trouble, we have so much unemployment in our area right now. Through giving and so forth, people.
I think one of the national trends in the last couple of years has been decreasing enrollment in the private schools, especially the new ones that have started up, because people can't afford that $600,000.
Isn't that one of the reasons they're starting in many cases? People send their kids to the private school so that they don't have to confront all socioeconomic and racial groups in the public schools. It's busing that's one of the things that started a move toward.
In larger community, we don't have that problem here.
Well, I think that varies, but the desire for the perpetuation of an elitist type school system for a homogeneous type school system put on into the future, does that mean that you want to preserve a privileged track for the oligarchy that will rule? And I'm using a mixture of vocabulary, not unpejoratively, as you observed. Or if you take the public schools, put it in the opposite kind of frame, do you want the whole level of education, or at least a redefinition of the easy way you use good education? What are the criteria for a good education? For what kind of society do you want that, to get down to something that is less good in certain kinds of intellectual activities, which have been the inherited component of good classical education? And we really have some strategy option. I didn't realize it was that sharp between the two Lutheran churches, but that's fascinating, that that philosophical discussion, theological discussion, is embodied in two fundamental commitments to strategies in the two churches.
Do the, church schools get children who have discipline problems? And is that some of the reason for
they don't have to take them?
No, that school won't take them.
Ours used to. That ours got overwhelmed by that.
Had to be escaped for that problem.
And you went. I mean, really, it got kind of known as well sensitive to BL, and there's nothing else to do with them. And that is a ministry, and they really like to have, like I said, a third of the kids be unsaved, or however you want to speak of it. But it can be an overwhelming problem the other way then, if the majority of the kids have come out as a discipline problem out of the public
schools. I have friends that have purposely, they don't even attend church, but they send their children to the Christian school because they're having a real hard time in public school.
Yeah.
And they feel they'll get more individualized help. Instruction.
Christian schools are probably more back to your square box.
Yeah, they are. They really in boxes. We want them in boxes.
We like our kids in boxes.
We discussed it last night. We like boxes.
I think the size of the classroom has a lot to do with it, too. Because the private schools tend to have smaller classes. That's another attraction.
Yes. Statistically, that has not been true with the Catholic schools. The Catholic schools often run 50 or 60 in a class. But they have the great advantage of choosing their pupils. If a pupil does not straighten up, how did they? Now, you run that one more degree over. There are some places, and Holden Village may have been one of them, where I taught in Georgia, where there was a mill village, where the way they would deal with undisciplined kids was to call the father in and say, you either straighten up your kid or you lose your job, and if you lose your job, you have to get out of the company house you live in. Or if they say it, it's profane. Yeah. Now, or if you have them in the public schools, how do you, in that kind of schooling, which dominates a whole lot of the energy in life for an X number of years, how do you bring in a religious type of dimension that you want? And that's been the question asked by all the church educational strategies that have not said, let's have a school that you can pump religion straight into. Let's hunt for the complimentary time, Sunday, weekday, afternoon, the way the Jewish tradition does it, or summer vacation period at Holden Village, or in a Bible school in the parish, or whatever. So that you've got a kind of balancing off with pluses and minuses of whichever strategy you choose. And it's interesting that we seem to represent in this room a lot of church experience that goes the AFC way, that says, let's try day schools and see if we can't somehow figure out how to make the church a more vigorous instrument by raising kids in a more protected environment where they can get religion head on.
I was going to comment on the reentry problem. I have a lot of freshmen who come to college, and for some of them it may be their first experience in a secular institution, or it may be that simply through Sunday school that they've been very specifically indoctrinated, some of them in very fundamentalist kinds of things, and their whole stance toward college, toward going to a secular college, is suspicious. And they're not open to ideas. They consider me a secular humanist, which is very bad, you know, a bad word in their vocabulary. And it seems to me that they're wasting their tuition money because they're not getting what college has to offer. They're not open to ideas. They feel threatened by just about everything. And I think that their school or their Sunday school should have prepared them to be open to what was available to them and not closed.
But isn't the opposite side of that coin this child who has to go to the public school because they can't afford it, which is in our area, if you aren't rich, you don't go to a Christian school. And they're forced to go to a public school where Christ is not allowed. You know, you can say, okay, we won't take these people in our schools in the private school, but in the public school, they say, okay, Jesus isn't coming here. And there are a lot of things the pressures they get, they have such conflicting values at school from what you try to give them at home, that it's very hard to raise your child to be a stand-up Christian, to say, hey, I really believe, when all of their associates are at school, or 90% of them at least, are saying, oh boy, you're really something to go to church and all that.
Well, I guess the question is, if you're not going to separate yourself like the Amish, then the question is, at what point should the child confront that? You know, is it better for him to confront it at age 7 or at age 17? Mm-hmm.
That's the question.
But they need something. They need the solid foundation built first before you thrust that decision on them, or that responsibility to make those choices alone.
They've got to have a confidence that they can face the secular issues
and
come out with a positive Christian answer.
Right.
You know, knowing that they've got a good basis and the answers are there, you know, and so that they're not frightened to confront them, you know, because they know that Christianity will hold solid and will provide some sort of answer, even if it's not a final type thing. But at the same time, to not be afraid to confront them.
Well, that is what
I wonder. Does this mean that Jesus is not in the secular school?
Not in ours.
What do you mean by that?
How do you discern the presence of the Spirit of God?
In the public school that my children went to for elementary, or most of their elementary, the pastor is about what I was going to say. The principal was a beautiful Christian man who taught Sunday school on Sundays, and that staff kind of went accordingly, and we were allowed to have Christ in the Christmas program, and the general flavor of the school was definitely moral and quite a large percentage Christian, just attitudinally. I mean, you didn't have a devotion in the morning, and we didn't even have a prayer time. But, and I know in one of our high schools, there's a group of kids that meet, like 70 kids, it's not a lot out of high school, 2,000, but that meet and have, we have a large Mormon community, they're quite active, which isn't Christian, but.
But even aside from that type of thing, I mean, God is everywhere and in everything. I went to a public school that was very, very non-Christian, very just typical American culture type of attitude, and yet, in all things and in confrontations between people and values and everything, there are always those challenges to your thinking, and there's always, you know, God working through so many different things, you know, and we can't say that, well, you know, he's not in the public schools at all, because even in the experiences that I had in understanding people and in understanding, you know, like levels of social, just so many different things, you know, there's that in understanding. Well, of course, you need the Christian teaching to have a viewpoint of that, but that doesn't mean you can't learn about God and about Christ.
While you were growing up in that arena that was secular, what was the help the church was giving you to ask the questions with an antenna to discern it Christianly?
Well, see, I wasn't really a Christian until I was about almost at the end of high school, maybe junior
junior heading towards senior year of high school. So I didn't really actually learn things all through my schooling from a Christian viewpoint, and yet God was teaching me. You know, God was bringing me to the point of eventually letting the things that I was learning through the church have an effect on me and bring me to a knowledge and an understanding of Him. But even though that wasn't through the means of directly teaching about the Bible or about Christianity.
Well, that really poses for us a theological question, doesn't it? Of whether, mm-hmm. whether the symbols by which we, within the community of faith, identify the presence of God, namely Jesus talk, prayer, activity, etc., whether that's the only way we can recognize and affirm God at work, or whether God is at work everywhere, working God's will, and that what we need is a double set of antenna, one that recognizes the supportive, enriching, contemplative within the community of faith and outside antenna to look for the behold kinds of things where in a tension relationship, without any prayer, without any Jesus talk at all, without any of the common symbols that are the core of our experience within the faith, we are helped to understand there is God at work, there is the Spirit of God, and we interpret it. The difference is not that other people who are not Christian don't experience God. It's that we have means of understanding it that comes from our particular tradition, which we think is vital. But is it possible for that balance to happen in the interplay between the sacred inwardness and the secular outwardness of our lives?
Our oldest daughter went to Augustana College, where there was a good, you know, a youth group, which she didn't take part in at all, although she'd been very active in Luther League and in high school and that sort of thing. Then she went to Stanford Medical School after that, and there she was very much involved in the Lutheran student movement, because there was that small group that had something in common, and she said it was much more vigorous and exciting than it was on the Lutheran campus.
Well, I think the strategy of a day school where you can really build obvious religion head on into it, in the curriculum studies, Bible is included, chapel is included, prayer is included, morality is interwoven explicitly. That strategy is fairly clear. Now, part of the interest I've had in London the last 6 months, I've been sitting in with the training of religious education teachers in a system that since 1870 has had religion imposed on every student. And the 1944 Act, interestingly the year in which that happened, requires every school supposedly to have an opening assembly of some religious sort in the morning and religious teaching for every student. Well, that's old Church of England nostalgia in most of England. And it is a mess. I mean, the folks that are at the heart of trying to develop programs and curriculum materials and trained teachers are just dealing with the problems of having religion built in that way when they're living in an increasingly secular society. And then what happens is that the forced religion turns the kids off, something off, and they cannot stand it. And so you've got that active hostility to the imposition, and that's part of the background of our religious freedom in the U.S. In other words, our resistance of having somebody else's religion, usually it was another denomination involved, but having to support that religion with our tax money just drove us up the wall and into the Bill of Rights that said, let's have religious freedom, let's don't have the government playing religious games on us. So that mixture now in East Germany is a fascinating thing, because in one generation since 1945, they've had to go from old Christendom, like West Germany, where every child gets religion in the school automatically, and they have some of the problems they have in England. to where they have no religion in the school. And in fact, a Marxist-Leninist kind of philosophy that often is interpreted very anti-Christian ways. And they are shaking through the same strategy question over there that we are. How do you then raise children in the faith? How do you nurture them when you've got to be separate? So the kind of strategy question that I think are being faced many places is, if we probably never will have the majority of Christian children in private schools unless we change our constitution radically. And we may do that. The Dutch do it a different way. They give money to a Catholic school, and they give money to a Reform for Reform school. We might do that one of these years, if the religious impulse continues to go that way, so that we then separate kids up through age 16 or older into denominational pillars, as the Dutch call it. Now that's a totally different kind of thing. That then would mean that we set up the opposite of what our public schools hoped they could do, and that was teach a kind of common morality necessary to the foundation of a democratic state sustaining itself through the decades, where everybody had to learn to know each other and appreciate each other in some way and deal with that person as a fellow governor of the body politic. And the fear of chaos led the early educators in the public school system to say democracy without morality, without a school system that teaches a common kind of way of acting, democracy without a school is chaos, anarchy. So that we're dominated by that, and that puts a kind of conservative hope into our schools. So we deal with that in different ways. Even if we do, the Catholics, who've made the greatest effort in this, don't have anything like a majority of their Catholic youngsters in Catholic parochial schools. So that the predominant strategy still has to be, how do we in our churches deal with the religious part of a total education when the compulsory part of education is not on the surface with its curriculum efforts and its religious exercises, where that part of it cannot deal with the religion? Then how do you deal with the religion elsewhere? And that's why people are concentrating on the intensity of life experience in the faith community. It says you don't have to live totally separate. You need to live separate a while, and you need to live separate for some very conscious purposes, like reflection, like worship, and like a certain kind of education that tries to help us be prepared to be, if you want to think of it, aggressively missionaries, to straighten out the bad things, or participants, move it back on the spectrum to Christ transforming culture as Christians live in culture, and we become one of the instruments for that presence of God out there to help ameliorate the bad things and create better things. So that we are really left with a sort of complementary strategy for the majority of Christians. And I think that's important for people to recognize who live in the kind of minority strategy, which it probably will be unless we change the Constitution, of the private religious schools, with the corresponding problem for them of then when do you introduce them to the rest of the human race that are bound with them together for well or for ill or good in this society. And there are no easy answers either way. And I think part of what we need is conversation between people involved in these different strategies to sort of help each other see what happens as generations of kids grow up in the kind of crazy world we live in today. Most of our discussion has still been sort of based on continuity. Whether the new nuclear threat, the ecological threat, is pervading the minds of the children that are growing up now and making them radically different types of people. Whether television is changing their ways of perception, that kind of thing doesn't easily get handled by the continuity of either of the strategies we have inherited that we've really been talking about improving today. And that's another kind of problem that maybe we can get to tomorrow. Good. Thank you.
Thank you so much.